Now, the Senate GOP health care bill falls apart. Two Indiana representatives are accusing each other of planting negative stories in the media, and another call for redistricting reform. Those stories and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending July 21st, 2017.
Ice Miller is proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
Well, local health care groups are attentively celebrating news that the Senate's latest health care bill is dead. After months of protesting the GOP's plans to repeal the Affordable Care Act, they're still not calling it a victory.
Teresa Torres of disability rights groups Everybody Counts and Adapt Indiana last month protested the Senate's Better Care Reconciliation Act at Senator Todd Young's office, and she was with a group of disability rights advocates who were worried the bill's cuts to Medicaid would threaten access to home-based services and community care. She says she's still worried.
It's not actually a victory so much as it is a reprieve. And we need to be grateful for that reprieve, but we need not to assume that it's done. You know, this was not a turning around of significant number of people who recognized, oh my goodness, this is, what are we doing? This is a bad thing.
The GOP's Plan B to repeal the law without replacing it with a new one was also shot down after a handful of Republican senators said they wouldn't support a straight repeal. This after Vice President Mike Pence told Republican lawmakers this week at the National Retail Federation Summit in Washington that inaction is not an option on Obamacare.
Congress needs to step up. Congress needs to do their job. And Congress needs to do their job now.
Well, is this the end of the health care debate or just the latest round? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Swantes, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Eric Berman of WIBC News. I'm WFYI's Taylor Bennett in for Brandon Smith. Well, Ann, a lot going on with this health care debate. The White House and President Trump kind of putting the blame on Democrats. What's going on there?
Is that a serious question?
Well, you know.
I mean, it's absurd. It's absurd on its face. Uh-huh. I mean, they control both houses, and they control the White House. Their problem is that they took, what, seven old white men, put them in a room, and tried to readjust 17% of the United States economy. It was absurd on its face. It was doomed to fail. There are lots of issues with Obamacare, and President Obama himself noted those for years and asked for cooperation to fix them. I'm hoping that Senator Lamar Alexander, who's now holding hearings mm-hmm. on stabilizing the insurance market, will actually step forward with a reasonable proposition. When Trump was running for president, he promised that he could come in like on day one, mm-hmm. redo the health care, cover everybody with a better program for less money. Baloney. I mean, he completely failed. In fact, he was missing in action. He was the one who called the health care bill that Luke Messer and Todd Rokita voted for as mean. And they're in his own party. They really do need to get some bipartisan support together. They need to get people who understand how the system works and talk realistically about what needs to be done to take care of Obamacare, and it does need fixing. Mm-hmm. Everybody admits that. There's never been a major piece of legislation passed in the history of our country that didn't need tweaking for years afterwards. This is the same. They ought to get serious about it. Too many people's health care and lives depend on it.
All right. Mike, what do you think? Are Republicans team players, or why can't they get something passed?
Republicans are the only ones doing anything right now in health care. I mean, Chuck Schumer has said, my door is open, but he won't answer the phone or won't show up to meetings when invited. So,
what meetings was he invited to? Certainly not when they were drafting the bill.
Mike Pence is absolutely right. This law, it's not the end of this, right? It can't be the end of this because it is failing. It is in the process of failing. If you're watching the show right now from Richmond, Indiana, starting January 1, 2018, you do not have access to private health insurance. You don't. So Medicaid's your only option. The federal government requires you to buy it, and you can't buy it because Obamacare, the restrictions that they've wrapped around these insurance companies have made it so expensive and cost prohibitive
to
cover people in the individual market.
That's why we need single-payer.
Let's go to a single-payer system that's also unsustainable. I mean, we're looking at, we need Medicaid and Medicare reform because the cost overruns on these programs right now are unsustainable. We're starting to see it in Indiana, especially in the Medicaid market, starting to see it. Certainly the commercial market's starting to see it. Therapies are getting more expensive. Certainly drugs are getting outrageously more expensive. They're miracle drugs, right? They're myometrics, they're these other things, but they cost tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars on therapies. So we've got to figure out the cost side of this. We've got to figure out where do we draw the line on a Medicaid expansion population where we cover able-bodied, working men and women who are maybe childless, but they're currently covered within the Medicaid program. So talk about the disabled kids. We're spending more resources on older Americans than we are on disabled kids right now, and that's because of Obamacare. So all of those, it's out of balance.
The reason you're paying for able-bodied people working is because we won't raise the minimum wage, and people can be fully employed in this state and still eligible for Medicaid because we don't pay them enough.
I think there was just a study out of Seattle that said that it's actually hurting minimum wage workers when they increase it to $15 because automation is accelerating.
I've heard that, and that's put out by the Chamber of Commerce, who doesn't want to raise the wages. I've heard that before.
The math's math. I mean, people either making more money or they're not.
Yeah, well, they're not making it in this state. That's why income tax revenue is going down.
Well, Mike, they say that, you know, maybe we'll have a vote next week. Are they going to have the votes?
We'll find out. I mean, it's changing by the day, right? So yesterday, part of the problem here is we have razor thin majorities. So we don't have 60 Republicans like Democrats had 60 Democrats the first time this came through. And people forget the fact that it took 14 or 15 months to pass Obamacare, and it took 5 years to implement it, right? So the fact that this isn't done in the first 6 months doesn't mean it's dead. Let's move on, because we can't move on. We've got to address it.
So Donald Trump was lying when he said he could do it then?
I think he fully intended to. I think it's just
you just didn't understand how things work. You got to go find 51 votes.
Yeah. Speculating on a vote next week is who's to say what would be voted on? Mm-hmm. It's such a moving target.
It is.
And you have Republicans not only in the Senate but in governor's offices around the country who arguably would be most damaged by dramatic cuts in Medicaid spending in the coming decades. They're the ones saying, you know, time out here. You have Brian Sandoval, who's a Republican governor from Nevada, who says it's like basically watching an Etch-a-Sketch. You shake it up and you know, it disappears, and you kind of start over and shake it up again. Even Eric Holcomb, our governor here, when pressed this week to take a position, says, you know, I'm not chasing rabbits. I'm not going to get into speculation. And it's kind of alarming that at this point in the process where you're talking about a final vote on a bill,
nobody really knows what it
would do or can agree on the numbers. You know, the administration, I'm not sure you can blame Democrats, back to your first question, because when there were the briefings for governors at the summer meeting of the National Governors Association, you had one Trump staffer briefing governors who basically, you know, criticized or bashed the Congressional Budget Office numbers, saying how crazy, you know, talk. And then the very next person, within a matter of minutes, up from the administration, used them as the basis for his argument as to advance the point he was making. So it's just the shifting sands have nothing on this.
So is that Republican fiscal responsibility? You pass a bill affecting 17%
of the... Ask one of the partisans. That's,
I don't think Eric falls into that category.
No, I appreciate that.
That's all right.
I would say, though, in terms of arithmetic, I would wager Mitch McConnell doesn't want to hold a vote on this because, you know, Lamar Alexander, you mentioned earlier, is that I don't even think we have 40 votes, much less 50. You know, you've got to find a bill that both Mike Lee and Susan Collins will vote for, plus you're missing John McCain, who's out sick, obviously. It's a tough haul, and normally you don't call a bill to the floor, especially a bill that's going to be a difficult vote for a lot of folks on either side when they go back home to campaign, if it's not even going to pass. But what we saw when they were struggling to get the votes in the House was President Trump wanted people on the record so that they'd be accountable. So you've got different agendas from the White House and the Majority Leader's office, I think.
I think they're going to be concerned what's going to happen in the election. People are going
to
be, you know, what are they going to think if they vote yes or no?
Yeah, and the election is, a year plus away. It's not clear how the politics of it shake out. It sure looks like an unpopular bill now, but that varies from state to state, and they've all got their own calculus to go through.
We have the first president in our country's history that says the buck doesn't stop here. It's an amazing world we're in.
And it's unclear when the pain would be inflicted. I mean, voters, would they rise up immediately based on CBO numbers and assessments that within you know, the 22 million, 23 million mm-hmm. Americans would be off the rolls in a matter of years? Probably not. The real pushback would come when Joanne voter finds out that, oh, mm-hmm. my pre-existing condition is no longer covered, or my 25 or 6-year-old.
You're underestimating him. I think there's enough media attention to this that people are aware of what's at stake.
Well, there's a lot of confusion.
If Obamacare hadn't passed in 2010, I don't think Republicans go win 3 or 4 congressional elections in a row on it. Right? I mean, what were you going to do in 2016, run against Obamacare on a bill that failed 6 years ago? I mean, if Democrats would prefer something bad pass, right? They would prefer that people are harmed.
Although
that's
the only way
the
politics.
I mean,
it's now favored by more than 50% of the public as opposed to whatever it was initially, 20-30%.
We'll definitely keep watching it. Yeah. So let's move along. Representative Todd Rokita and fellow Republican Luke Messer are both accusing each other of planting negative stories in the media. Now, both have not ruled out seeking the Republican nomination to run for Senator Joe Donnelly's seat. And that could be sparking this mudslinging.
A recent post in Politico Pro revealed that Rokita had used $100,000 in campaign funds on use of a private plane. And the story pointed out that he had broken no ethics rules or laws. Rokita said that Messer planted the story to distract from an Associated Press story that reported that Messer's wife has a contract with the city of Fishers for $20,000 a month. And Messer's office said Rokita's claims were unsubstantiated.
Well, Mike, these two apparently have a long, it seems like peaceful relationship. They went to college together. It didn't seem like there was anything negative going on between them. Is this because of that race that they could be entering?
Yeah, Wabash always fights, right? I guess
it's very competitive.
We're going to find out if it works or not. I mean, the race, the field isn't set to start with. Neither of these two guys are officially in it yet. It's certainly speculated that they're going to enter it. But beyond that, other people may get in as well. And I think with the risk they run right now, and I've known both of these guys for a long time personally and think very highly of them. But the risk I think they run right now is that you have rank-and-file party people who understand that we're going to have to work really hard to beat Joe Donnelly because he is not going to be easy to beat. And so in this primary process, we're looking at these candidates saying, all right, literally, like, this isn't a walk. Like, whoever wins the primary is going to win the general. That is not the case. We've got to pick the best candidate who's going to go attack Joe Donnelly's record and make him accountable for it. So we need him to focus on that instead of themselves.
Well, it seems like it's getting
right
pretty
now,
personal.
But they could be doing, mm-hmm. in my mind, is if there are a couple credible candidates outside of these two that are looking at this race. If there's a third credible candidate standing there right now, I think they catch a lot of support watching Rokita and Messer kind of do this back and forth. So it'll be long forgotten, you know, come next spring when we're voting on this, or voting for one of these two guys. But is it working? We'll find out, I guess.
John, is this kind of bickering, is this normal?
Not necessarily. I mean, Ronald Reagan's somewhere rolling over in his grave talking about the 11th commandment, thou shalt not speak ill of other Republicans. Mm-hmm. And I think you're exactly right, Taylor. This friction would not have arisen if there had not been this lust, perhaps, for the same position. That is, the Senate office currently held, so the seat currently held by Joe Donnelly. I mean, if you can have two dogs that are best friends until somebody throws the steak out, you know, the red meat, and then they're going to go at it. And I think in rather crass terms, that's what we're seeing here. Competition for one position brings out the daggers.
Mm-hmm. Except last year you had two Republican congressmen who wanted the same position in the primary that Todd Young ultimately won. And that was certainly spirited, but it wasn't nearly at this level. I mean, we're already hearing words like unhinged, and this is exactly what I'd expect from him. And it's July. What's it going to be like in April?
It's a hot July. It's been hot.
It is a hot.
Everyone's uncomfortable.
I think that's,
long, hot
I think that's
more unhinged by then, I guess, if that's the process.
I think that's the point. It's very personal, and mm-hmm. it's not going to be forgotten by next year. And it does give comfort to somebody else looking at that race to come in and see, because, you know, the two of them are in a food fight is what they're in. They're like acting like kindergartners mm-hmm. on this. At the same time, they're voting to kick 400,000 Hoosiers off health care insurance. So people are going to look at that and say, is this really what I want representing the state of Indiana? So it would certainly give as you, I think, said, I don't think you said aid and comfort, but certainly encourage a third party to enter that race.
All right. Well, moving on. It's time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, are you tired of dishonest politicians? A, yes, they all lie. B, no, I still believe most are honest. Or C, I don't listen to any of them. Last week's question, will the Donnelly family company's outsourcing cost Joe Donnelly the election? Well, 29% said yes, 51% said no, and 20% said it's too early to tell. Well, if you'd like to take part in the poll, you can go to wfyi.org/IWIR, and you can look for the poll. Well, a rally was held at the State House this week calling for redistricting reform. Some at the rally accused some state lawmakers of redrawing district lines to help win their own elections.
One of those speakers was Democratic Representative Carrie Hamilton.
This is about the fundamentals of our democracy and competition in our elections. And I think as more and more people realize that, that it's not only not partisan, but it's basic to our democracy working well, folks will get on board.
A bill that changes how the state draws its districts was quickly killed at the State House this year.
Well, Eric, it didn't go anywhere this year's session. Why is it? A lot of different issues going on. Did it get lost?
I think it got lost. You know, it's tough to get non-financial things done in a budget session. I mean, you've got more time to work with, but the budget always has attention. This year, obviously, road funding got a lot of attention. It did get a hearing, but basically the House Elections Committee wasn't ready for it. I assume it's going to be back next year. There's a decent chance it'll get a hearing next year. Whether it actually passes, that's way too soon to tell.
Is it too political?
Well, I don't know how you do redistricting without it being political.
Right.
I mean, the interesting thing about this is you'd expect that this is something where the minority party would be pushing hard for it, which has been the case with both parties in the minority, and the majority would be holding the line. The majority party, at least in the House, Speaker Brian Bosma has said over and over again, I think we should do this. Todd Rokita was one of the big proponents of redistricting reform when he was Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. So there is Republican support for it. I'm not sure that there's a majority of support with Democrats and Republicans. This is an issue that's going to cross party lines, and you know, we'll see if they have 51 and 26 or even if it moves through the House and Senate.
Is it going to come up in the next session?
It'll come up. Will it pass?
Mm-hmm. That's
a tough call.
Yeah. All right. Well, Senate GOP leader David Long didn't wait long to anoint a new chair for the Senate Appropriations Committee.
Long named Ryan Mishler to replace retiring lawmaker Luke Kinley as the Senate's budget architect. Mishler has served for 5 years as the number two senator on the powerful Appropriations Committee. Mishler will assume his new role after Senator Kinley steps down this fall.
Well, John, he has some big shoes to fill at the State House.
He does. Certainly the occupant of that position, or its forerunner, Larry Borst, you know, you look back to when you had tax and fiscal policy and appropriations all together in finance, and you had this sort of iconic figure that ruled with a firm hand in terms of budgetary matters in Larry Borst for a number of decades. Then you had the same model, albeit the title slightly different, with the restructuring of the committee assignments with Luke Kinley. You know, everybody during the budget process always says, well, don't worry about now. It's always, we'll see what happens when it gets to the Senate and when it would get to fill in the blank, you know, Larry Borst or Luke Kinley. So now that person will be Ryan Mishler. I think the appointment of Ryan Mishler makes sense in many ways. If this were the Broadway play and you were going to get your handbill on the way in, this would be the little slip of paper that says the understudy is playing the part of committee chairman tonight in the place of Luke Kinley. As you pointed out, Taylor, Ryan Mishler has been that understudy, so to speak, as ranking member of the committee for 5 years. He has also chaired the subcommittee on school funding formula, which I think we all agree is probably the toughest aspect of the state budgeting process, certainly one of the most controversial every biennium. So here you have somebody who certainly doesn't have the experience necessarily of his predecessors, but I'm sure will learn on the job, and it'll be interesting to see, I think, the interplay now between relative inexperience in the Senate in that role and the House counterpart in Tim Brown, who at the House Ways and Means Committee chair has been in place now for, goodness, I don't know, I mean, a number of years.
Three budgets.
So it's it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Mike, how important is this committee? I mean, kind of take us through a little bit of what this committee is responsible for.
It's the spending committee,
it's
right,
powerful.
in the Senate. So Senator Hirschman chairs the Tax and Fiscal Policy Committee. A lot of tax issues go there. They do a big tax rewrite bill every session. It always goes through that committee. But the budget is really crafted and put together in consultation, certainly, with Senator Hirschman has a huge role in that and probably will have an outsized role now than what he's traditionally had just because of his seniority and his experience. But it's powerful. I mean, it's the most powerful committee in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
There's a small group of people that work together to craft these state budgets after they've received input from state agencies and the public and other legislators who bring their priorities from home. But then at the end of the day, it's a pretty tight circle of people that are making the numbers work, and they've made it work. Now we just passed our seventh State House Republicans passed their seventh straight balanced budget. So yeah, he's got big shoes to fill, but he's got great experience, and he's had a great mentor in Senator Kinley.
All right, well, look forward to
it. Got another tall white male from Northeast Indiana. A lot of diversity.
Well, the other two were from Central Indiana.
Well, not long.
Oh,
and
okay.
Come on.
Well, you got the predecessors in that committee.
No.
All right. Well, Indiana ended its recent fiscal year with a small budget surplus, a healthy overall reserve, but the reserve falls short of last year's total.
Now, the state closed its fiscal year with a reserve of nearly $1.8 billion. That's about $400 million less than the year before. Office of Management and Budget Director Micah Vincent.
That was a one-time expenditure into roads. As can be seen, we now have a long-term, robust roads plan with those needs going forward.
Revenue from sales and corporate taxes did better than expected, but individual income taxes came in slightly lower than the most recent forecast.
And what does a state do with a budget surplus?
Well, frankly, that budget surplus is too high. I mean, we haven't spent the money we need to spend on roads, on preschool, on opiate addiction. There are all kinds of things it can be used for. Having said that, we need to be somewhat careful because the way they've cut the corporate tax, that revenue is going to go down. And unless Congress or the courts fix sales tax through the Internet, the sales tax revenue is going down, and on top of that, income tax is going down because, of course, Indiana has not kept pace with wages with the rest of the country. So you've got the two balanced things, but we've got more in the surplus now than we had going into the 2008 recession, and we weathered that. So, you know, how much is the state supposed to be a bank, and how much is the state supposed to spend money on essential things that mean a lot to the quality of life for Hoosiers and for the next generation? That's the question. We don't even seem to debate that. We just say, oh, we've got a surplus. Terrific.
Mm-hmm.
End of discussion.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about 11 or 12% of the annual spend. I'm old enough to remember 2008, late 2008, when the economy cratered, and we had to go cut $2 billion in spending. Like, in 3 months, we were entering the 2009 budget session. We went to special session that year because it was so hard to make ends meet. And at the time, Democrats assailed Republicans for cuts to education and cuts to Medicaid and cuts. We had to cut everything. We had to cut across the board because we had a healthy surplus at the time, and it did enable us to weather it.
And then you had George Bush in the White House, and he made everything too for
you. It enabled us to weather it, but it was only because we had it in place. And so, I mean, what Ann just described was, the surplus is too high, we need to spend it. Oh, and by the way, revenue is dropping.
Yeah, well, the surplus was lower than it is now. Okay?
And we
weathered it.
I thought
you'd
be happy.
$400 million.
I thought you'd be happy.
Donald Trump in the White House. He certainly won't make the same mistakes George Bush made. Right? So you should be very confident.
You're throwing a lot of pitches right now, Ann.
This is one of those issues, it seems to me, where your position on the surplus is determined by whether you're a member of the party that's in power or not.
Well, we didn't have a surplus when the other party
well,
was in power.
I take it
that's
maybe,
because of your recession.
Actually, it's always somebody else.
Either I'm older than you guys or maybe I'm dreaming this up. But I do remember when Republican leadership had a number of news conferences, and at one point they were going through a grocery
they wanted to give it
to
back.
Show what would happen
$100 a person.
If the Biden administration gave it back and what every Hoosier could buy, and they filled up their carts. So
the line was, the state is not a bank. That was the line back then.
My point is simply this.
It probably
makes good fiscal sense to have a surplus. My point is simply that this, like so many other things, whether your party's in power or not is going to shape what you say about it. That's the only point I'm making.
Thank you.
Well, it's fun to talk about money, but let's move along. Sunday will mark the 24th running of the Brickyard 400. So any predictions, you guys? Let's start with you, Mike.
Truex Jr. has been winning DraftKings for me all year, all season, so I'm going to go with him.
Okay. Eric?
Never bet against Jimmie Johnson.
That's
fifth
right.
Brickyard.
That's right.
Wow. Why are you betting?
Well, no, but
it
if one
be,
were betting.
That would be illegal, and you would not do that.
I'm already in a contest.
He already has acknowledgement of this, counselor. That was my pick, but I'll go.
Well, you can pick that, too.
Okay.
I'll
throw my support to Eric Berman and to Jimmie Johnson.
Okay. Ann, what do you think?
I'll go with Danica Patrick.
There you go. Me too.
That's the winning answer?
All right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Anybody going to the race?
No.
Rickets.
Okay.
I'm going to bring my son out on Saturday. We'll spend
a little,
day
little too hot.
It's going to be very hot.
I've been to the race.
I've been to the race, too.
It's always fun.
All right. Well, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Swantes of Indiana Lawmakers, and Eric Berman of WIBC News. Well, if you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR. Or, starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity. I'm Taylor Bennett of WFYI News. Brandon Smith will be back next week. Join us then, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Ice Miller is proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.